From NPR and WBUR, I'm Jeremy Hobson.
I'm Tanya Mosley. It's Here and Now. The House of Representatives is voting today on a $3 trillion economic relief package that so far does not have Republican support. And this morning, White House economic advisor Peter Navarro dismissed testimony by whistleblower Rick Bright, who said there isn't a national strategy to respond to the pandemic.
It was the height of irony that the day that Bright was up there doing the circus thing, President Donald J. Trump was out in the beautiful Lehigh Valley, essentially announcing a key part of that plan, Strategic National Stockpile 2.0. It's in President Trump's image. It's smarter, bigger, and more resilient. What do I mean by that?
In case you missed it, by the way, here is some of what Dr. Bright said yesterday on Capitol Hill.
Initially, our nation was not as prepared as we should have been, as we could have been. Some scientists raised early warning signals that were overlooked, and pages from our pandemic playbook were ignored by some in leadership. There will be plenty of time to look back to assess what has happened so we can improve. But right now, we need to focus on getting things right going forward.
Let's bring in Tolu Olorunipa, White House reporter for The Washington Post. Tolu, let's start with Rick Bright. He was removed from his position as a top government vaccine expert, he says, because he raised alarms about the pandemic response from the administration. How is his testimony resonating in Washington today?
Well, his testimony is largely a bombshell for those who have been critics of the administration, who have been wondering why the American response to the coronavirus has been so haphazard and so delayed. Dr. Bright provided not only details, but also evidence that he and a number of other scientists and government experts were trying to warn the government, or were trying to get the red flags to begin to flare about how much of a major issue this was back in January and February, and those warnings were not heeded. So he has been able to provide some of that evidence that a lot of people have been looking for in terms of trying to find out why this was not handled in a more responsible way, and why the White House and the political figures seem to have played a much more significant role than the scientists and the experts. And that's part of the reason why you're seeing people trying to defend President Trump, like Peter Navarro, in part because there is a fear that this narrative is starting to build that President Trump and his political allies were not listening to the experts. And that's part of the reason why we are where we are now.
Well, some of what is happening now is outside of the White House's control. President Trump praised the Wisconsin Supreme Court's ruling this week that overruled the Democratic governor's stay-at-home order. Republican lawmakers wanted the restrictions lifted in Wisconsin, and they won. Now people are packing into bars and restaurants in some cases. Is President Trump, by praising that ruling, now saying that all stay-at-home orders across the country should be lifted?
Well, that has been his message. If you've looked at his social media accounts, at his public comments, he's really pining for this grand reopening, even though a lot of these states have not met the guidelines listed by the White House in terms of what they need to do before they start to relax their restrictions. President Trump has kind of moved on beyond that, and he's speaking out in favor of reopening, saying that all of the states that have not yet reopened are doing it for political reasons, and essentially saying that all states should begin to relax these restrictions. He has said it should be done in a gradual way, but a lot of that nuance gets lost when he starts speaking publicly and attacking Democrats who have been resistant to reopening their economies. He has praised Wisconsin for opening. He's retweeted messages that say, you know, don't worry about wearing a mask or staying home. You should feel free to go out to restaurants and bars without wearing masks. And it's clear that his own personal views are at odds with the views of even members of the White House Coronavirus Task Force, who have said that we need to be very cautious about reopening because we don't want to have a second wave of the virus. The president has said instead that this is all going to go away by itself and there's no need to take precautions. And that's part of the reason why there's so much uncertainty about what the federal government response is, because there doesn't seem to be a clear and consistent message coming from the White House.
Well, and there's no question that there is severe economic devastation that is being caused by everything that is happening right now. House Democrats are voting today on more cash payments to families, additional help for states and businesses, and expanded unemployment benefits. What are the sticking points? Why aren't Republicans willing to go along with this at this point?
Well, a number of Republicans say that this is too much, too fast. They want to take a little bit more time to see how the first multi-trillion dollar packages that have been passed, how they work, how effective they are in sort of stemming the economic damage. And they also believe that Democrats, you know, were willing to put in a lot of their pet projects into this major, massive bill. Things like, you know, vote by mail in all 50 states and, you know, diversity studies for different industries, things that Republicans generally have not been in favor of. They say that this has been a grab bag, and for that reason, they're not going to support this. But there are some things that they do support in the bill. So this is sort of an opening bid, which will lead to more compromise. Things like funding for states and localities is likely to be part of whatever bipartisan package comes out of this. But this was just an effort by Democrats to be able to sort of provide a message platform about what their priorities are, so that then we could go into a full negotiation on a bipartisan basis, and Republicans and Democrats will eventually have to come up with a broad package that will be able to help the country, because the packages that have been passed so far have stemmed the damage, but there still is a lot of economic hardship out there.
Just a few seconds here, Tolu, but should we be paying attention to what President Trump is calling Obamagate, or is it just noise?
It's mostly noise if you look at the actual details of what he's alleging. This idea of unmasking is something that's very common. It's been done in the past. It's been done under the Trump administration. But it is an effort by Trump to try to cause a sense of distraction in the middle of a pandemic.
Mm-hmm. Tolu Olorunipa, White House reporter for The Washington Post. Thanks as always.
Thank you.
Oil and gas companies could benefit from a change to a Federal Reserve stimulus program aimed at helping businesses during the coronavirus pandemic. But some are calling these changes a stealth bailout for the industry and question whether they make sense from an environmental or economic standpoint. Reed Frazier of the Allegheny Front and State Impact Pennsylvania reports.
When it first rolled out its Main Street lending program, the Federal Reserve prohibited companies from using the loans to pay off debts. The loans were intended to help small and mid-sized companies from going under during the pandemic. But oil and gas companies and their advocates asked the central bank to loosen up those guidelines. They wanted to use the money to be able to pay off debt, too. The Fed's rule change, announced in late April, allowed just that. In a video, U.S. Senator Kevin Cramer of North Dakota said the changes will help American oil companies. He says they've been hurt by coronavirus and the oversupply of oil from the Saudi-Russian price war.
It's created a valley, and we need a bridge to the other side of that valley for these highly leveraged companies. And this will be one of those tools, I think, that will help build that bridge.
Oil drillers in Cramer's home state and other states like Texas stand to benefit the most from changes to the $600 billion loan program, which was part of the CARES Act, the $2 trillion coronavirus relief bill passed by Congress in March. But some have criticized the Fed's changes. Environmentalists question whether the government should be throwing a lifeline to the fossil fuel industry, one of the country's biggest sources of greenhouse gases. Graham Steele of the Stanford Graduate School of Business and a former Democratic congressional staffer says the changes could help companies that were doing poorly well before the pandemic. And he says that's not what the CARES Act is for.
This is an oil bailout for a specific set of companies.
The Federal Reserve said in an email that changes to the program weren't made with the oil and gas industry in mind, and that other industries could benefit. Business groups like the U.S. Chamber of Commerce also lobbied for the changes. But Steele says the big winner is oil and gas.
It structured the program in a way so as not to lose taxpayers' money. And now members of Congress and industry have lobbied them, and under that pressure, they have buckled.
David Livingston with the Eurasia Group, a risk management firm, says allowing companies to use the loans to essentially refinance higher interest debts will help oil and gas companies. He says they've had to borrow because revenues from oil and gas alone have not been enough for them to cover their costs.
They were sort of running on a treadmill, and the entire shale enterprise was increasing its production month over month, year over year, in large part thanks to the continued provision of relatively low-cost capital to the sector.
The idea was that prices would eventually rise and they'd cash in, but the opposite has happened, at least for oil. The crash in oil prices has actually increased the price of natural gas. Since oil wells also produce natural gas, when oil production slows, less natural gas comes onto the market and the price for natural gas goes up. That's been good for shale gas companies in Appalachia and other places across the U.S. But Bill Holland, who covers the natural gas industry for S&P Global Market Intelligence, says some of these companies are still paying off debts they accumulated leasing millions of acres of land during the fracking boom.
Companies spent big to lease big tracts of land in western Pennsylvania, West Virginia, Ohio, in the Utica and Marcellus shales. They grabbed that land, the land grab we called it, and that debt's still on their books.
One company that could benefit from the Fed's new loan program, Holland says, would be Chesapeake Energy, which has a big loan payment coming due this year. But it's unclear whether Chesapeake could qualify for the loan. In a recent regulatory filing, the company announced it's considering filing for bankruptcy. For Here and Now, I'm Reed Frazier.
You can clap at home if you want to. All right? You can even move at home if you want to. There you go. I see you moving. I see you moving. In your robe and your house shoes. Brush your teeth, though. Let's go. Sing!
I got is an awesome gun erased from heaven above with me. Some power and love of God is an awesome God.
Sing it, John.
Award-winning gospel singer and songwriter Kirk Franklin has been pretty busy during quarantine. You just heard part of one of his at-home concerts, which he shared on his YouTube channel Easter weekend. And while Franklin's larger-than-life presence has always been on stage, these days he's taking to social media to reach people. And he joins us to talk more about it. Kirk, welcome to Here and Now.
Thank you so much for having me.
So, you know, every time I look around, there you are. You gave this Mother's Day message just a few days ago. It wasn't even just a message. It was like a full orchestra playing in your yard. You do these YouTube concerts. You did this especially moving video about the latest on Ahmaud Arbery. You're working nonstop, it seems, and you're building connection virtually these days. What drives you?
I think I'm just driven by life. I am a student of good and bad, and I've always been inquisitive, you know, as I never want to be the know-it-all in the room. I want to be in the room of those that are thinkers and people that are compassionate and people that have drive and ambition. I'm always driven by that. I've tried to apply that even in my Christian faith or even in my cultural experiences or my social anxieties as a Black man, my fears as a father and my heartbeats for my wife and my kids. And so those things drive me.
You brought up your wife and your kids. And really the first thing I think when I think about you, in addition to your expansive music career, is family, the importance of it. It's something we're all thinking about right now. We're either with them in quarantine or we're away from them or we're reflecting on those we've lost. You talking about always wanting to be in the room with people who make you better. You're there with your family right now, but you're also providing an experience where you're connecting with us online. Talk to me a little bit about that.
It's very interesting. You know, I am just always trying to pay attention to how to communicate things that may not always be the hot topic issues in ways that can be entertaining and engaging. That's what I think has always been my passion, you know, even if it comes to the type of music that I do. And, you know, but with family, a lot of the stuff really is organic. Like, you know, like even the Mother's Day thing, like I hadn't thought of that weeks ago. You know, they didn't know what they were going to be doing. I had them do their parts in their phone. I just had them, you know, do it on just kind of like a voice text and send it to me. And went into the studio and kind of put it all together. So, you know.
We're going to have it on our website so folks can see what I'm talking about. But, you know, I think anyone who has watched you perform knows that there really is no sitting down with your hands in your lap. These performances are an experience. I mean, they are high energy. It's praise music. I mean, I'm even standing up right now talking to you because, you know, you obviously don't have an audience right now where you're doing these concerts in front of them. But do you miss the energy of the audience?
To be honest with you, I don't feel emotionally a difference just because, you know, it is still very easy for me to just still be that guy. Like I'm not having to be another guy.
Yeah.
You know,
it's you. It's what you do. It's your gift.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And that's not anything to, you know, to try to puff myself up or to try to, you know, boast in anything. I'm just sharing with you what moves my heart. And that's what moves my heart.
Yeah.
Speaking of some of your collaborations, when we were talking about some of those IG concerts and YouTube concerts, you collaborated with several artists, including Kelly Price and Fantasia, for a rendition of your song Smile. Let's listen to some of it.
Oh, it fell from heaven like a shower.
You know what I was thinking about, Kirk?
What is that?
When you hit the scene back in the 90s, I was in high school, and I remember it was such a huge deal because it felt like you were bringing contemporary sounds to gospel music. When we listen to that now, like, it is very current, it's very now, but you kind of brought this to the forefront in a way that opened it up for people who may not have been either in the church or listened heavily to gospel music. When you think about that, just your legacy in that way, does it still feel brand new to you? Or do you feel like we've come so far in this time now that we've just evolved with the music?
No, it's still new to me just because there's always a new mountain. You know, there's always a new bridge to cross. There's always a new experience that has to be communicated. Like my heart really is about making sure that the conversation of Jesus Christ is something that can be a relevant conversation regardless of where culture finds itself. Like, I wanted to have a fabric that it can bob and weave out of politics. We're talking race, we're talking social injustice, we are talking pandemics, whatever it is we're talking about, that I want to be able to bring a light into whatever area of darkness that may exist, that will cause people that are atheists, agnostic, people that are cynical, can be able to hear the hope in the subtitles. And so that's what, you know what, that was kind of good. I like that. They can hear the hope in the subtitles. Mm.
Yeah. Mm. I hear the sermon coming on with that one.
I hope not, because, you know, is I want it to just be a conversation, you know, is I don't want to preach to people. I just want to love on people, man.
You got to tell us if this is true. I read somewhere that you received your first record contract offer at 7 years old. Is that an urban legend?
No. Well, there was a boys choir or like a band or something that wanted me to perform, and they were going to take me on the road. And my mom said no.
You must have been pretty dynamic for that offer to happen. What were you doing? Were you performing publicly?
I had a play uncle that performed in clubs. And so he would let me come sometimes, and I would do songs with him, like Bad Bad Leroy Brown, and all the type of little things that would kind of go on. And so I would perform and do music with him.
That's amazing. And since then, your career has spanned decades. Your first album, Kirk Franklin and Family, was back in 93, sold a million copies. It was like an explosion. Since then, you have won many, many awards, released about a dozen other albums. You know, but I want to ask you about your activism. You know, we talked a little bit about Ahmaud Arbery. You took to Instagram with that very intimate video. You framed it in a way that said, hey, we're all dealing with this devastating disease, COVID-19. And this message is not to discount that, but our country needs to grapple with this other disease that we've had for hundreds of years. And that's racism. Yeah. Can you say more?
Yes. You know, the problem is that you can't legislate morality, that you can't pass policies that are going to turn the hearts of people, that prejudice, you know, has to do with deeper areas of wiring that we as humans have to address. And that's why I believe that when it comes to the hearts of men and women, that the only thing that can get past the core of our prejudices is love. And it can't be the love that we say to each other during Valentine's Day. It's got to be a supernatural love that is bigger than the cosmos. And so I'm just trying to do my part as a flawed human to try to bring context to it.
Mm. Can we anticipate more at-home concerts from you?
It's almost like the first few weeks, everybody was excited about it, you know? But I'm quite sure that by the time you got to your 50th Zoom call, it was like, all right, all right. I'm ready to go outside to the river and down to the lake. But I think that our country or the world right now, we are at the most vulnerable moment that we've ever been, because I think that people can hold hands and kumbaya for a minute. And then after that, there's an echo of anger and rage. And I don't know if the kumbaya right now comes that. And so I'm praying and hoping that whatever my voice needs to be, you know, that God will give me the wisdom on how to do that, to be able to speak to the second stage of this lockdown, because we are stronger together.
Kirk Franklin, thank you so much for joining us. This was a pleasure.
Oh, great honor. Great honor. Thank you for having me.
Everyone tries. Life cuts so deep. Feels like you'll die. No cross, no crown can give up now. Please.
Beaches in New Jersey will open on Memorial Day, according to state officials, with some limits on the number of sunbathers and social distancing in place. This move is expected to boost the state's tourist economy. Maine also relies on summer visitors, many from states where the virus is still rampant, which is making business owners worried that summer may be over before it even started. Maine Public Radio's Fred Bever reports.
In Old Orchard Beach, it's spruce-up time for the fry shacks and pizza parlors, the roller coaster, the tilt-a-whirl, and the town's many low-rise hotels. At the Waves Oceanfront Resort, workers like Raxme Yee and owner Ken Lafayette also have something else to worry about, the coronavirus.
So we're keeping some of the pools closed. We're not opening all our pools because...
But the pools are the safest thing. I mean, look at all those chemicals. There's no way any...
It's about the social distancing on the pool deck.
Well, just, you know, so you can't sit on the deck and just only swim in and out.
It's one of many new COVID-19 era concepts that Maine's tourism leaders have to contend with. In March, Lafayette bought a new property based on its long history of repeat customers from Canada. But now, President Trump sealed the border indefinitely. Lafayette says he's lost bookings worth at least $500,000.
So I almost feel like a failure. My brother will tell me it's not my fault. My wife tells me it's not my fault. But all the optics and gauges that I use... It's just demoralizing.
And not just for him, but also the 80-plus seasonal workers he planned for, whose job prospects are now uncertain. Tourists spend more than $6 billion a year here, supporting about 1 in 7 jobs.
We're looking at the right down the gun barrel like a lot of people are.
Susie Hockmeyer's Northern Outdoors River Adventure Resort should be ramping up for the season now. But the rafts are still in storage, and she's trying to figure out how to maintain social distancing through all of her operations.
A boat is 16 feet long, and it has 4 different thwarts. So if you kept, you know, people in the same household in the first few thwarts, you probably get almost about a 6-foot distance between the guide and the people up front. It's possible we have to put a mask on the guide.
If they even get the chance. Commercial lodging in Maine is mostly shut down. That changes next month, but visitors from out of state will have to quarantine in place for 2 weeks before doing anything else. The hospitality industry says that's just causing problems, and leaders are begging state government to modify or lift that restriction. And there is hope that more prevalent coronavirus testing could help. Much depends on the pandemic's progress in hard-hit Massachusetts, which is the single biggest contributor to Maine's tourist population. Meantime, tourist towns like Old Orchard are testing ways to meet the needs of the day, closing streets so restaurants can stretch out a bit, coordinating beach openings, creating new cleaning regimes for all-important public restrooms.
The world is crazy now. Who was expecting this?
Rocco Ferraiello wears a mask as he shapes pizza rounds in his store. He's worried about making the rent, but he has some hope.
You know, I think if everybody does the right thing, mask, the gloves, this and that, everybody can work. Everywhere, you know, and every shop.
Another restaurant owner says it's not time to think outside of the box anymore. It's time for a whole new box. For NPR News, I'm Fred Bever in Old Orchard Beach, Maine.
Norway's prime minister said today that travel restrictions to that country will stay in place until late August, even though a number of other European countries are easing similar restrictions. And an EU official said this week that there will be a summer tourist season. Joining us now on Skype from Berlin is the BBC's Damian McGuinness. Damian, how easy is it to travel in Europe right now? How much are trains and planes operating?
It really very much depends, Jeremy, where you're going to and where you're coming from. So since the coronavirus pandemic has hit Europe, what most European countries have done have they put up border restrictions. That's changed travel overnight in Europe. And for most people, that has meant you could not go to different European countries unless you had a very specific reason. That is in a process right now of changing. So we're in a period of flux. So what's happening right now in many European countries, people and various governments are starting to lift those restrictions. So, for example, Germany has now announced that there will be no border controls anymore to Luxembourg. There will also be fewer border controls, simply spot checks rather than actual border controls between France and Germany. The Baltic states, for example, Latvia, Lithuania, Estonia, they've now just announced they're going to have their own mini free travel region where the borders between each country are going to be completely free. So it really very much depends where you're traveling to, where you're going from. But I think what we're going to see now is more and more of these restrictions being lifted depending on the development of the virus.
So you have these little travel bubbles. What about Americans? Will they be welcomed in Europe this summer?
I think certainly American tourists would be welcomed. The difficulty is each country is going to have its own particular rules because each country is at a slightly different phase of the pandemic. So, for example, the situation in Germany is looking relatively positive. Germany has just now scrapped rules calling for other European citizens who come into Germany to go into a two-week quarantine period when they arrive in Germany. For travelers coming from outside of Europe, that could also be scrapped at some point in the future. So a country like Germany, Austria, where the virus infection rates are relatively low, and so far the pandemic seems to be relatively under control, travelers might find it easier to go to those sorts of countries. Other countries like Spain, even Spanish people can't travel within Spain, for example. So Spain would probably not be very welcoming to tourists. Even if American tourists can get into Spain, they wouldn't be able to travel within the country. And they might find as well that hotels aren't even open. There's lots of factors going on, which I think American travelers will have to take into account.
You know, as you talk about all these countries in Europe, there's one country that the whole world is kind of watching, which is Sweden, which has done things very differently. And they've had a lot less restriction in terms of movement and in terms of businesses being allowed to open. What are the thoughts on Sweden within Europe right now?
Yeah, it's difficult to say, really, because Sweden is also in a period of flux. At the beginning of the crisis, Sweden very much relied on people voluntarily engaging in restrictive measures and safety measures. That changed over the past month or two. So they've become more restrictive, but still they have a more liberal approach, you could put it, than some other European countries. It really depends which figures you look at, because according to some figures, the death rate per capita is actually relatively high and certainly much higher than other Scandinavian and Nordic countries and their neighbours. So some people would say the Swedish approach is not working. Sweden would argue that actually their approach is a long-term approach. So the Swedish government says that if you lock down too harshly, you can't keep those measures in place long term. And then as soon as you release the measures, then the virus sparks up again. But I think the jury is still out as to which approach is correct, because every country is doing their best and every country has slightly different development, and no one really has the correct answer so far just yet.
That is the BBC's Damian McGuinness speaking with us from Berlin. Damian, thank you.
Thank you, Jeremy. It was a pleasure.
Well, one of the many things getting more use because of widespread stay-at-home orders are home wastewater systems, septic tanks. In fact, the number of homes with on-site sewage treatment in this country has been rising, raising concerns from some environmentalists. Joining us now for more is Sarah Hager. She's an engineer, researcher, and instructor in the on-site sewage treatment program in the Water Resources Center at the University of Minnesota. Welcome.
Thanks for having me.
Well, first of all, how many people in the country have septic tanks, and is that number going up?
Yeah, so across the U.S., it does really vary from state to state, but if you look at across the U.S., that number is about 25%. And that number, according to the home builders, is actually increasing. We don't have fabulous data about this because the last time this question was really addressed nationwide was in the 1990 census. They are planning to currently add that question back, so we will in the future probably have better data. But home builders have been collecting data, and they have been reporting that that number has been increasing.
And is that just basically because more people are moving out further away from cities into rural areas and even deeper into suburbs, and they just don't have the infrastructure there to have a town sewage system?
Yeah, generally that is the reason that extending sewers also into rural areas is very expensive. And if you think about where a lot of people live around metropolitan areas, it's in, you know, that give or take hour range of, you know, a downtown city. And you really can't, in many instances, affordably extend a wastewater treatment plant that far. Mm-hmm. Also, we've really developed a lot of the easy land that was easy to plat with a wastewater treatment plant connection. So a lot of the areas that we are now developing are far beyond that extent. Very often, it's a less costly option to treat your wastewater closer to where you're collecting it. So again, people basically have little wastewater treatment plants in their backyards. The typical treatment we're going to see from those is certainly comparable. The difference is, again, that's something now that the property owner is responsible to both pay for and manage.
And there are some pretty big environmental concerns about the rise of septic tanks. Tell us about those. What are the disadvantages when it comes to the environment?
I would say the largest disadvantages is that many of the septic systems that were put in the past, sometimes people call these like legacy systems, aren't up to today's standards. So the most common impact we see across the U.S. is to our surface waters. So in areas that have fresh water, like in the Midwest where I live, the risk there is phosphorus reaching our lakes, rivers, and streams. If you live more in a coastal area, the concern is nitrogen. And because improper treatment of nitrogen can cause toxic algal blooms. But varying municipalities and states have kind of different tracking of those systems and management requirements. And so that's still a non-universal kind of application, is like how our systems actually being managed across the U.S.
Now, you mentioned the algal blooms, and in fact, the big ones that we saw in Lake Erie and in the Gulf of Mexico in recent years, septic tanks were actually one of the contributors to that. They're not the only cause of that. But what about the issue of sea level rise, especially with septic tanks that are close to the coast? What are the concerns when it comes to water levels rising, and then there's this thing underground that may be a problem?
Yeah, so septic systems to work effectively do need a separation from the bottom of the septic system. And keep in mind that a septic system is, at a minimum, a tank followed by some sort of drain field system. That drain field is a soil component that helps treat the wastewater. So we design those soil components to be above the water table. And keep in mind, there's kind of two water tables in many parts of the U.S. Sometimes there's like a very shallow groundwater, and then there's the deep groundwater where we're pulling like our drinking water from. But we are designing our systems to be above even that shallow groundwater. So if sea level rises and it impacts where groundwater is, that could negatively impact septic systems.
Are there parts of this country that have no wastewater treatment at all, no sewer and no septic systems?
There are pockets. I wouldn't say there's any state or any given area, but there are areas that are underserved when it comes to wastewater treatment. So there's been an area identified in the southern part of the U.S. and even in the state I live that has pretty progressive environmental regulations. We still have communities and even individual homeowners that don't have appropriate wastewater treatment. It's a very large public health issue. It's not just an environmental one. It's sewage spread sickness, improperly treated sewage. So that's definitely a priority that's gotten some more recent attention.
That is Sarah Hager, who is a researcher at the University of Minnesota there in the on-site sewage treatment program, the Water Resources Center. Sarah, thank you so much for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
House lawmakers are voting today on a $3 trillion relief bill from the Democrats. It would send $1 trillion to state and local governments and another $1,200 check to individuals. Already, Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell has said Republicans will not consider the bill unless it includes liability protection for businesses. For more, let's bring in Neil Bradley. He's Chief Policy Officer for the U.S. Chamber of Commerce. Neil, thanks for joining us.
Well, thanks for having me, Tanya.
Yes, well, of course, we are in unprecedented times, and this is such a complex issue, but there are valid points on both sides. On one hand, you have businesses saying, there's no way I'm going to reopen if every single employee who comes down with COVID-19 is able to sue me. But on the other hand, you have people calling for the opening of businesses for the sake of the economy. What are you hearing on the business side?
Well, you know, what we're hearing, and it's not just from businesses, it's from universities and nonprofits and, you know, really employers kind of across the spectrum, is that first they want to do the right thing and reopen safely. But in the course of reopening, what businesses and nonprofits and universities want to make sure of is that if we follow the appropriate public health guidance issued by the best minds at the CDC and OSHA or in our state, then we don't want to be second guessed, you know, a year from now when someone brings a lawsuit suggesting that we should have known that we should have done even more.
We've been hearing stories of hairdressers in Georgia trying to essentially deal with this on their own, making customers sign waivers. It's not really clear how enforceable those are. But what are you seeing in terms of litigation? You know, Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell has warned this is coming, major litigation. Or is this idea theoretical right now?
Well, it's not theoretical. We're already beginning to track hundreds of cases of litigation that have been filed. We also know that there are some people, unfortunately, who are looking to profit off of these kind of lawsuits. So, you know, amazingly, in some parts of the country now, there are advertisements on television soliciting individuals to become plaintiffs in litigation. It's really disappointing when we should be focusing on fighting the pandemic, getting people back to work in a safe manner, that people want to go out and spend money to try to figure out how to recruit plaintiffs so that they can sue businesses and nonprofits.
So, of course, we know that businesses want to do the right thing. But there are some industries we know that have records of workplace abuse, even before their workers started getting sick and dying in this current crisis. How do you make sure a few bad actors like these don't take advantage of any sort of new system that we're talking about?
Well, we have to be very careful about how we write that system to avoid that very outcome. And so what at the U.S. Chamber, what we're recommending, what we think is likely to be considered on Capitol Hill, is a very narrow, targeted, temporary safe harbor. So it's not immunity. It's not some of the things that you may have heard. What we believe is appropriate here is a safe harbor that says, if you follow the guidance issued by public health officials, then you have a safe harbor against being sued. If, however, you don't do that, if you are grossly negligent, if you engage in willful misconduct, then there's no safe harbor for you, and you can be sued as you appropriately should be sued for being a bad actor.
Well, one federal agency that really has the potential to make a big difference in all of this here is OSHA, the Occupational Safety and Health Administration. House Democrat Ro Khanna of California actually said he'd be open to giving a liability shield to companies if OSHA requires them to develop strong worksite-specific plans on how they're going to protect their workers. But so far, OSHA hasn't done that. They've more so issued these broad guidelines.
Would that be an acceptable trade-off in thinking about the commerce and in all of this?
Well, the devil, of course, would be in the details. When OSHA normally, when people usually refer to strong regulations from OSHA, it is literally the 200-page rule book, for example, that applies to, a medical facility, for example, that is developed over years and implemented over time. And it's only applicable to certain kinds of facilities. Here we're talking about trying to adopt public health and safety measures across nearly 8 million business establishments, plus nonprofits, plus schools, across the entire country. And so I think it would be difficult to have a strict regulatory approach. We at the U.S. Chamber would be supportive of better guidance. We think we will learn more every day about this virus and how we can help stop it. And so the guidance ought to evolve and ought to be improved as we learn more. But that's a far different cry than kind of a strict regulatory approach, which frankly wouldn't be practical in terms of protecting public health.
That's Neil Bradley. He is Chief Policy Officer for the Chamber of Commerce. Neil, thank you so much.
Thanks for having me.
And Here and Now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Tanya Mosley.
I'm Jeremy Hobson. This is Here and Now.